Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, June 23rd, 2016, a busy day in America's courtrooms.
Hear ye! The court's in session. The court's in session. Now, here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Here come the judge!
Yes, from Los Angeles to Baltimore to the United States Supreme Court, we got some interesting rulings today. And first and foremost, a decision that will live forever in the rock and roll courts. Robert Plant and Jimmy Page were found not guilty of plagiarism in their creation of this song, Stairway to Heaven. A jury in Los Angeles said that they didn't lift the chord progression in this song from a tune written by Spirit's Randy California way back in 1967. But there are far more important court decisions that were handed down today, starting at the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., where the undermanned, there's one justice who died and he hasn't been replaced, the eight-member court deadlocked on a very critical issue and handed a major setback to President Obama. The issue, of course, is his executive action on immigration issues, and it, of course, stemmed from the longtime recalcitrance, the obstruction of the House of Representatives to take up any measure related to immigration. And so the president looked at what he thought was available under executive orders, and in 2014 he issued the order called Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, or DAPA. And this would allow the so-called Dreamers, children of illegal immigrants who have grown up in the United States, have never been to their parents' native land, and who would be subject to deportation. And the president, as a group, announced that these people would not be subject to deportation. And this was challenged by Texas and 25 other states. They filed legal challenges to the president's decision. And the way it worked, since the court could not come to its own decision, they were hopelessly deadlocked 4-4. They issued a one-line statement acknowledging the deadlock and saying that the lower court ruling would stand. That lower court came from the appeals court in New Orleans that upheld the ruling of a Texas judge who had placed an injunction on the president's action. And while this deadlocked decision does not set a federal-level precedent, it does have the effect of killing Obama's effort for the remainder of his presidency, and it really reduces us to gridlock, complete gridlock, on the issues related to immigration. And that makes it a topic that is ripe for jingoists like Donald Trump to, essentially blame Obama for the inaction of the Republican Congress. And this is part of the overall effort to discredit President Obama, to limit him. And it is compounded by the Senate Republicans' refusal to even consider the nomination of the replacement justice, Merrick Garland. Now, I'm not a big fan of Merrick Garland. He is a very moderate pro-government judge. But Obama nominated him because he had been approved by Republicans in the past. He was trying to call their bluff. And this recalcitrance by the Republicans is really putting more glue into the machinery. And we will look back at this in 10 or 20 years and see it for what it is. It was race-based obstruction of the first African-American president. And a statement that came out of the Obama campaign. There's still an Obama campaign. Can you believe that? I got on their list to find out who his VP pick would be back in 2008, and I've never gotten off. It's kind of like a no-fly list, I guess. But they issued a statement that I concur with. Quote, "This is another consequence of congressional leaders failing to do their jobs. Not only are Republican Senate leaders hobbling our judicial system with their unprecedented obstruction of President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, but our immigration system remains broken because Congress continues to kick the can down the road on finding a comprehensive solution. And some people are gloating that this means the voters will decide these issues in November. But picking between Trump and Clinton is not the same as having our elected leaders do their jobs and find common ground on the contentious issues of immigration policy. The Supreme Court also surprised me by rejecting a challenge to a race-conscious admissions program at the University of Texas in Austin. The vote was 4-3, with Justice Kagan recusing herself because she'd worked on the case when she was Solicitor General. And it's a very interesting majority, this 4-3, because the screamers in this case are the dissenters who lost the vote, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and his conservative buddies, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. And they're squawking because, they feel that this is, let's quote Justice Alito, "This is affirmative action gone berserk," adding that what the majority had done in the case was misguided and is simply wrong. Alito denounced the court's affirmative action ruling, saying the university had not demonstrated the need for race-based admissions, and saying the program benefited advantaged students over impoverished ones. So this is another byproduct of the Republican Senate's refusal to do its job. The Constitution clearly says they don't have to confirm the president's nominee. They simply have to hold hearings and a vote. And by refusing to do that, it produced this result today. Now, it's anyone's guess. If the Senate had cooperated and confirmed Justice Garland, this case may have been deferred to the next term to allow the new justice to get up to speed, and sometimes they even schedule additional oral arguments when there is a new member of the court. So we can't predict or project what might have happened here. But if Scalia had still been alive, it's pretty clear that the decision would have been in the other direction. The Supreme Court also took up a case from Minnesota and North Dakota related to the right of a driver suspected of driving under the influence to refuse not only a blood test but also a breathalyzer. So in a 5-3 decision, they said it's a crime for drivers to refuse a breathalyzer test when they're suspected of drunk driving, but they did place limits on penalties for drivers who refuse to submit to blood tests for alcohol levels. And this is a very interesting parsing. Essentially, the justices say that, blowing into a tube or a balloon is not as invasive as having blood drawn from your body. And it is a criminal penalty. There is a criminal penalty imposed in Minnesota and North Dakota if you refuse to take a breathalyzer test. Here in California, it's not considered a crime. They just suspend your license if you refuse to take the test. So that's an interesting decision that the court determined today. Also in Baltimore, the judge who heard a bench trial in the case of the Baltimore cop who drove the van driving Freddie Gray to death, well, that cop was acquitted on all charges, second-degree murder and 6 lesser charges. This is the third case where a judge has ruled against the prosecutor and in favor of the police officers who had Freddie Gray in custody. And if we predict from here, it would be that no one will be held accountable for his death. The judge, Barry Williams, rejected prosecution's claim that the officer had given Gray a rough ride in the van, intentionally putting him at risk by not belting him and by, driving over bumps and, taking sharp turns and that sort of thing. We know that cops do that. And it appears they did it in this case. But the judge said there was insufficient evidence to convict. Meanwhile, the Democrats' sit-in on the House floor lasted about 25 hours. It actually started on Wednesday when veteran civil rights protester John Lewis, congressman from Georgia, led an effort to bring Democrats up to the near the podium there, the well of the House, and they did a sit-in, blocking the scheduled business of the House that day. The Republican majority declared a recess, and in doing so, it automatically cut off the video feed to C-SPAN. And so to continue coverage of this protest, the Democrats used their cell phones and the Periscope feature and I think some live streaming on Facebook to connect with people outside of the Capitol. And C-SPAN actually picked up the feeds at different times and was airing them when it couldn't get the official feed from the House of Representatives. So this went on for hours, and I watched part of it. And, you know, I am so I'm so split about this. Because on the one hand, it is great to see Democrats stand up and fight for something. They're fighting for the wrong things. But they stood up and fought, and it is political grandstanding in an election year. And I'm not offended by that. In fact, I think it's nice to see Democrats organize and confront the wayward majority led by Speaker Paul Ryan. But it's also fair to say that what Ryan described this as a publicity stunt is pretty accurate. And Ryan went on to say that the bills that the Democrats want brought to the House floor have already been defeated in Republican-controlled House committees, and they were defeated in the Senate earlier this week. And as you know, I'm relieved that the Dianne Feinstein Senate bill that would block gun purchases by people who are on terrorist watch lists and the no-fly list, I'm glad that that was defeated. And we'll get to the details of why that's such a bad bill or a proposal in a moment. And so, after 2 a.m., Speaker Paul Ryan appeared. He tried to gavel the House into order. He was not successful. And amid the chaos, he held a vote to pass a spending bill, which includes emergency funding to address the Zika virus. And shortly after that passed, he called an adjournment, not a recess, but he adjourned the House until the 5th of July. And this collapsed the pressure point that the House Democrats had, because they were trying to pressure the Republican leaders to leave the House in session heading into the recess break for the 4th of July holiday. And because it's an election year, these are extended so people can go home and curry favor with donors and maybe some voters during the barbecue break. So it's an interesting effort on the part of Democrats. And it's important to note that the bad bill, the no-fly, no-buy proposal, that has morphed into a compromise bill, is still alive in the Senate. Now, Mitch McConnell used a parliamentary maneuver where he scheduled a bill for a vote on a motion to table it, and then Republicans voted not to table it, which means that it's out there in some sort of legislative limbo. So it could be called up at any point, but it appears that Susan Collins is short somewhere between 10 and 14 votes to get the 60 vote that is needed to proceed to a real vote on the bill. So it is alive, but it's hard to say where it goes from here. I want to commend Olivia Becker, who writes for Vice News, because this article headlined "Democrats Pissed Off More Than Just Republicans with Their House Sit-In" is the first media outlet report that I have seen. Now, I don't get to see everything, and I'm sure there could be somebody else out there. But, you know, I survey 8 or 10 publications and outlets every day, and I haven't seen anyone describe the situation quite this way. And it's really important because Becker writes, you know, many people applauded the Democrats because it seemed like their elected officials were finally doing something about gun violence. But, she writes, upon closer inspection, Democrats may have rallied around the wrong piece of legislation. The sit-in focused on a proposal to ban people on terrorism watch lists from purchasing firearms. Few people are in favor of that, but civil liberties groups have warned that such proposals are dangerous. And I'm one of those people. Hundreds of thousands of Americans are placed on watch lists for reasons that are not public or subject to due process. The ACLU says that the whole thing is too broad and vague of a system to be used to infringe on someone's constitutional right to purchase a firearm. Now, under the proposal in the Senate, the applicant for a gun permit would not be able to see the government evidence used against him or her. That means a right would be denied based on secret evidence, which violates a number of fundamental due process protections. Now, as I have argued, the way to fix this is to fix the no-fly and terrorist watch lists. But Democrats just, toss that aside when Republicans raise the issue. And while I'm loath to give any ground to Republicans, they have a proper point here. And Democrats could win the day and assuage the concerns of civil libertarians like me by saying, well, the first thing we want to do is fix these watch lists and make sure that there is a transparent process for how you get placed on it, how you get off it, and what rights might be compromised because you're on that list. If they would at least go that far, I might entertain a measure of this sort. Meanwhile, Jason Leopold Advice News reports that a Senate committee, the Intelligence Committee, included an amendment in the annual intelligence spending bill, which is an effort to crack down on the cozy relationship between the spooks and Hollywood. And this really came to the forefront with the propaganda film Zero Dark Thirty, which purports to give us the real story of the capture of the assassination of Osama bin Laden. And there are 20-some other projects where the Hollywood community has gotten support from the intelligence community, including shows like Top Chef. I mean, how do you insert spook stuff into Top Chef? I guess I need to watch to find out. And while the show Homeland is not listed here, I consider Homeland to be propaganda and fear propagation that benefits these government agencies. And as you may recall, in the film Zero Dark Thirty, the producers and the director, who is pretty well known in Hollywood, her name is Bigelow, Catherine Bigelow, cast Tony Soprano, the actor James Gandolfini, to play the role of Italian-American CIA director at the time, Leon Panetta. Now, I've known Leon going back to when he was a member of Congress in the 80s and 90s, and to see him depicted by Tony Soprano in this movie had to be a huge ego stroke for Leon. And that's just one example of the way the Hollywood community can play the intelligence community. We also learned that Bigelow gave gifts to some of her CIA contacts that could amount to bribery. And so Dianne Feinstein and Richard Burr, the top members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, are doing something for once that I actually approve of. They are saying that this measure requires that before an intelligence community element may engage with the entertainment industry, the head of that element must approve the proposed engagement and notify the Congressional Intelligence Committees at least 30 days in advance. Feinstein was really pissed that she didn't find out about it in advance. But here's the capper. The amendment notes that the engagements described in partially declassified Inspector General reports cost taxpayer dollars, raise potential ethics concerns, increase the risk of disclosure of classified information, and consume the time and attention of intelligence community personnel responsible for United States national security. And with all that said, I'll sum it up with a line borrowed from a Visa commercial. But propaganda? It's priceless. Today I'm releasing to my subscribers an exclusive interview with Sabrina D'Souza. We have followed her case for several years here. And D'Souza, who worked for the CIA, was deployed in Milan, Italy, with a State Department cover at the time of the kidnapping and rendition of Abu Omar from the streets of Milan, and one of 26 Americans convicted by Italian courts in absentia. Sabrina D'Souza is the first of those to face extradition to Italy to serve a 4-year jail term. She is currently on pins and needles, waiting in Lisbon, Portugal, for the cops to knock on her door and take her to Italy. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Sabrina D'Souza. So this, in my view, was a botched episode from beginning to end. And the agency and the people who approved this have never been held responsible, have never even acknowledged responsibility. And now you appear to be on your way to serve a prison term in Italy for the blunders of your superiors.
No, you've described it quite well, Peter, as a matter of fact. And I think, so this whole operation was planned in Rome, and the approvals were done at the highest levels of both the Italian and the U.S. governments, and all the way up to the National Security Council, because Italy is a NATO country. So to me, even more troubling is that Abu Omar was rendered to Egypt and released within a year for lack of prosecutable evidence against him. You see, renditions are meant for individuals, at least that's the framework under which they are on, who pose a clear and imminent danger. Abu Omar was already under investigation by the Italian police, and the Italian police had in fact dropped investigation of him 3 months before the rendition because they deemed him not to be a worthy target anymore.
You can hear my full conversation with Sabrina D'Souza. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com and all of our outlets. Also, a portion of the interview was videotaped for inclusion in this week's NewsBud report. And as you know, I'm very grateful to all the people who funded NewsBud through our Kickstarter campaign. We are up and running and very excited about our future. I also like to pause every day and thank the people who support my work here at this podcast with your subscriptions. People like Terry Paris, Annette Fenner, who just took out an annual subscription recently, Jeffrey Kay, who just renewed his annual subscription, and Don Cisney, who is a regular and generous supporter of the Peter B. Collins podcast. Come on over to my website, peterbcollins.com, click the menu button, then become a subscriber, and you can follow the guidelines from there. I very much appreciate your support. Oh, and one other note, I got a flare from the Shuler family, Roger and Carol Shuler. Roger, of course, is the journalist who's exposed so much of the corruption in Alabama and paid an incredible price for it. They're once again living on the edge, short of cash, could be homeless within a week or so. And so if you're in a position to help them, please go to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com and hit the PayPal button there and do what you can. And you have my thanks for that. Steve Horn, a longtime contributor to this podcast who writes for DSmog Blog, he's got a really powerful story that just came out a couple of hours ago. Yesterday, I reported to you about the court in the West, Wyoming, that overturned the fracking rules that had been placed by the Department of Interior on fracking operations on public lands. Well, the court overturned it, but the backstory is fascinating. And Steve reveals that the IOGCC, which stands for Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, which is supposed to be a place where government meets the industry to work issues out, well, it's where industry bribes government to get its way. Now, I may have overstated it there just a bit, but I'm linking to Steve Horn's article so you can read the details and some of these somewhat incriminating emails that show that the IOGCC was used by industry to help leverage opposition to this policy, and they had a victory in the courts this week. In Colombia, the government and the leaders of the FARC, the FARC rebels, have signed an historic ceasefire. Hopefully it will end the 50-year conflict between the government and those rebels. And it's a long-running dispute that's involved many different players, one of them being the United States, which has covertly supported the Colombian government through what was called Plan Colombia for many years. And I hope that this will lead to a disengagement by the U.S. and meddling in the affairs of the nation of Colombia. And finally, we are watching carefully the events in Great Britain today. It is the day that they vote on the Brexit referendum, whether Britain will exit the European Union. And we're showing high turnout. The polls indicate that it is too close to call at this stage. So I will be sure to update you tomorrow on the outcome of the Brexit vote. That's my news and comment for today. You are authorized to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.